This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Janae Desmond-Harris, aka Dear Prudence, and I want you to tell me about all your problems. Each week on Slate's Dear Prudence podcast, I'm here to tackle your questions about relationships, sex, work, family, and beyond, all with the help of an expert guest. We'll help you navigate it all, whether you're a teen dealing with parents, an adult looking to spice up your sex life, or you just need some validation that you're not losing it. We're here to listen and to offer some guidance. Need help? Just ask Prudy. New episodes every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. As the number of reports from mainly women and girls about sexual assault, misogyny and harassment by boys at our schools continue to rise, your messages this week have consistently pointed the finger at one culprit, online porn. So today we're going to talk about it. If you have children nearby, you may wish to turn the radio down. Although we're going to not be talking explicitly per se, our conversation does need to be frank and not shy away from realities and will contain adult themes. So porn, it is here to stay. And yet, while we know that both young men and young women watch it, as well as, of course, older men and older women, research shows porn is more commonly seen by boys, and the majority of boys think that what they're seeing is a realistic portrayal of sex versus 39% of girls. My question to you then today is, how is the way we behave and view sex and women influenced by how women are portrayed in porn? In other words, if porn depicted a more realistic version of sex and showed women having sex as equal partners rather than having sex done to them, would things improve? Do you watch porn? How do you find it from the female perspective to our female listeners? I know we've got many male listeners as well. Does it have an impact, do you think, on the way that you view sex, the reality of it, women, men around you? How has it changed the way you view sex of yourself and also your relationships? And how much do you lay the blame for what's been going on in schools between some boys and girls at porn's door? Tell us your take on this, but crucially that question around the depiction of women in porn. How much do you think that could change the game? Because porn isn't going anywhere. 84844 is the number you need to text. Do check what those costs are associated with that. On social media, we are over at BBC Woman's Hour, or email us your views and experiences through our website. Also, on today's programme, the novelist Erin Kelly on her latest thriller set in the competitive world of elite ballet, and women's knickers. Can they really persuade and boost the number of female recruits to join the Swiss Army? I kid you not, more detail on that to come. But first, you will have heard this morning that Germany is restricting the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine for people under 60. The German health regulator says it found 31 cases of a serious and unusual blood clot occurring, but this was out of the 2.7 million people who have received the vaccine in Germany. We know that all but two of these cases were in women aged 20 to 63. 9 people have died. Canada and France are limiting the use of this particular vaccine to over 55s. But AstraZeneca has said international regulators have found that the benefits of the jab outweighed risks significantly, pledging, though, to continue to analyse its database to understand whether these very rare cases of blood clots associated with thrombocytopenia occur any more commonly than would be expected naturally in a population of millions of people. It also said we will continue to work with German authorities to address any questions they may have. The European Medicines Agency and the World Health Organization has called on countries to continue using the vaccine, and the advice here in the UK continues to be that the vaccine is safe. Here to explain more, and particularly with the focus on women, Dr. Peter English, retired consultant in communicable disease control and former chair of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
This rare type of blood clot seems to affect women most. Tell us what you would say to the women listening who are concerned about trusting the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. They may have already had it.
Well, it does affect women more than men. About 3 cases in women for every 1 case in men. But that's got nothing to do with the vaccine. That's always been the case. So it's a non sequitur to link that to the vaccine, really. We've got no reason to think that the vaccine causes this at the moment.
And yet the statement from Angela Merkel has alarmed people, or could have alarmed people, I suppose. So that's why we're trying to talk to you today, trying to separate fact from fiction.
Well, the first thing to remember is that what causes blood clots, there are various things, but one of them is COVID disease. You're much more likely to have a stroke or a heart attack or other forms of clotting disorder as a result of COVID-19 disease than anything else. The vaccine, if it causes it at all, causes it in the sort of 1 in a million sort of level of rate of increase of symptoms of cases. And it probably doesn't. I might be able to come back to why I don't think it does. But the key thing to hold on to is that if you want to avoid getting a clotting disorder, you want to not get COVID-19. And the best way of not getting COVID-19 is to get vaccinated.
Sorry, so why don't you explain what you were just going on to say there?
Okay, well, rare conditions are common. Sounds weird, but yeah. When I was training as a GP, I was told that 1 in 15 consultations would be about a rare condition, not a particular one. There are lots and lots of different rare conditions. And that's the problem when you start looking at rare conditions caused by or associated with vaccines. It's very hard. There will be some rare conditions. By the nature of the fact they're rare, there aren't that many cases. So you won't get a big number of cases in your vaccinated group and your unvaccinated group. The numbers will be small, and it's very hard to know if you've got 10 in one group and 7 in the other, if the 10 in one group represents a greater risk or whether it's just a play of chance. And if you have a lot of rare conditions and you look at one, you find that one comes out more as having more cases in one group than the other, well, you'd expect that for some rare conditions because there are so many of them. Some of them, just by chance, in a particular pair of cohorts will be more common in one than in the other. The only way, once you've established a possible link like that, is to start afresh with a new studies where the hypothesis at the start of that study is there is a difference between these groups. But you have to do that with a new study that's looking specifically at that rather than having used what might have happened by chance in a previous study.
So do you think
that's why it takes some time to bottom these things out?
Do you think Germany is wrong then to be restricting the use of the vaccine?
Absolutely, they will be causing deaths from COVID-19 disease by damaging confidence in the vaccine and by delaying vaccination. COVID kills, and COVID causes strokes and heart attacks and other clotting disorders. If you want to avoid dying or clotting disorders, get vaccinated. So even if there's a minuscule risk from the vaccine, the risk is greater from the disease than from the vaccine.
But how can you be so confident, again, going back to what Angela Merkel had to say, which was around that these are new vaccines and it's new to us to be able to see so many people having the vaccine. We need to be transparent about this. And especially as we're talking on Women's Hour, how can you say to people so confidently, say to women so confidently, not to have these concerns?
Because although we can't 100% rule out that these conditions are caused by the vaccine, it's possible they are. We don't know. My bet is that in the future we'll discover that they are not. Why should one particular clotting disorder be caused by this vaccine when other clotting disorders aren't? We picked out one and then we're focusing on it. But even if it is caused by this, you've got a much greater chance of having clotting disorders or death from the disease, and the disease is common, than from the vaccine. We do know, even if we can't 100% rule out this being a consequence of the vaccine, we do know that if it is a consequence of the vaccine, it's an incredibly rare one, whereas it's a very common side effect or consequence of the disease.
And for women who might be thinking, I shouldn't be on the pill and then go and have this vaccine, what do you say to that?
Well, we went through this a couple of decades ago when there were some studies looking at the relative risk of clotting after if you're on the pill or some types of pill compared to not being on it. And they had a lot of publicity and a lot of people stopped taking the pill. Actually, the risk was two or three times greater, but it was two or three times an extremely small number. Just like here, we've got to, you know, if this vaccine causes these things, it does it in one in a million or so of the recipients. So three times one in a million is still only a very, very, very small chance. And yet with the pill, getting pregnant, it interferes with your clotting and makes you more likely to have strokes and DVTs and pulmonary emboli. Having a baby, even more so. So by stopping taking the pill, a few people got pregnant and some of those got clotting disorders because they're much, much, much more common with pregnancy and childbirth than they are with the pill. And you actually had a lot more cases there. So again, if you're on the pill, the safest thing is to avoid getting COVID-19. The safest way to do that is to get vaccinated, even if this vaccine, which it might possibly do, and I doubt it, causes one in a million or so cases of clotting disorders.
If you've had the vaccine already and you're listening to this report and the reports about this and you're concerned, what are the symptoms of a clot to watch out for?
Okay, well, I found a page on the NHS. You look up symptoms of blood clots. It talks about throbbing or cramping pain, swelling, redness and warmth in the leg or arm, or sudden breathlessness or sharp chest pain, which may be worse when you breathe in and a cough or coughing up blood. That would be with the pulmonary embolus. So there's the DVT, the clots in the arms and legs, and the clots in the lungs that you're particularly worried about.
And I suppose just to conclude and to reiterate, from your perspective, and it certainly seems like this with the European Medicines Agency and the World Health Organization and what the British government is saying, we should carry on as we are.
Absolutely. Even if, in the remote chance, this vaccine does cause these side effects, they are far, far more common with the disease, and you're likely to get the disease at the moment if you're not vaccinated.
Dr. Peter English, retired consultant in communicable disease control and former chair of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee, talking there about Germany's decision and what it might mean for you and what some of those questions you may have are. So we're hoping to answer those for you this morning. You've already started getting in touch with us around our discussion to do with online porn. I'll come to your messages very shortly, but we know the reports of sexism and assaults in schools detailed on the Everyone's Invited website you've been hearing a lot about in the last few days has opened up the conversation about abuse in schools. And the issue we keep coming back to is around easy access to pornography and how much that is the problem. Back in 2019, a survey of over 1,000 people carried out online by Delta Poll for the BBC Three documentary Porn Laid Bare showed that over three quarters of young men, 77%, and nearly half of young women, 47%, admitted to watching porn in the last month. We've had many emails coming in on this subject throughout the week, and one that we wanted to share with you came from a teacher who did want to remain anonymous, but we voiced up to share her experiences.
I've been teaching in London schools for 25 years. The sexualisation of girls, the unwanted attention, the touching, the masturbating in front of them, the messages, the catcalling, and the physical assaults on girls by boys within school is rife. Senior med teachers are usually male and they're loath to involve the police. Female staff are also abused by boys in school, verbally, physically, and increasingly by boys putting up websites that they can share images, photographs of teachers, up their skirts or down their cleavages, or photos that they found from Facebook accounts. To say that boys don't know what they're doing is quite frankly ludicrous. They may not know the law, but they certainly know that this is morally suspect. Partly this is why boys are doing it, to keep pushing those boundaries. It's a power dynamic.
It's a power dynamic. Let me read a couple of your messages before I introduce our guests on this. I'm deeply concerned at the prevalence of inter-family porn within the mainly free access porn sites using the terms stepmum, stepsister. These depictions can create threats within families that parents may be oblivious to. Please don't overgeneralise the style of porn as being about sex being done to women. Voyeuristic experience of sex is potentially more informative than other mechanisms of sex education. Porn does include a large proportion of forceful and inappropriate sex. However, there is a choice of less masculine, dominant, even female-controlled sex. perhaps generate some better quality and more helpful styles of porn and find a better word to describe it. Yes, perhaps that's all to talk about. The types of pornography made, this other message reads, and consumed are indicative of a wider societal attitude towards women, that sex is something to be done to them or taken from them. Watching pornography itself isn't a bad thing, but better sex education, seeking out quality, well-made porn, which you'll have to pay for, and giving women and girls agency over their own sexuality would all be helpful. It's too easy to access porn showing women as passive objects rather than active participants, but that is a reflection of our wider society's attitude towards women's sexuality. The two feed each other. And I'm sure two women who will not be short of an opinion on this, Dr. Fiona Vera Gray, Assistant Professor at Durham University, who works on violence against women and girls, and Cindy Gullop, Founder and Chief Executive of Make Love Not Porn, the platform. We'll talk about what that is in just a moment. But Fiona, if I could come to you first. We just heard from that teacher about boys masturbating at school towards girls. Do you think that would be happening without porn?
This is the thing. It's not a new, but the situation we're in now is not new. This isn't wholly different than situations and generations that we've had before. So research that I've done recently, I did the largest single study on women's experiences of pornography. And what I found there was that from women from 18 to 70, was across generations, women were accessing pornography in the same ways when they were younger. But what's different is the type of pornography that they're accessing now. And we really can't separate that from some of the behaviours that we're seeing amongst young people. So the types of pornography that young people can access today, we need to be really serious about it. These are forms of pornography and pornographic representations that are illegal to access offline. So they're not the things as when I was younger that a lot of people were able to access when they're younger. And the thing that's really important about that is that young people are seeing these before they've had the opportunity a lot of the time to start practicing their own versions of sex, to start thinking themselves about what sex might be, what it might look like, what might feel pleasurable. And so it's starting to really blur that boundary. I think some of what you were saying at the beginning, we need to start thinking a little bit more about this idea that there's porn sex and then there's real sex, because actually the two are starting to blur together in a way that we see when we talk about, you know, the offline world and the online world. For young people, that distinction doesn't really match up to their reality. And I think that it's the same with porn. So we need to start asking different questions about pornography. We need to start asking, you know, who does it benefit for us to desire the kinds of sex that we're seeing in mainstream porn, sex that isn't about human connection, that's not about mutual pleasure, that's not about equality? Whose version of sexual freedom is this? And we also need to start asking really important questions about what are the stories of gender that porn is telling us. And that's some of what we've touched on here as well, because that message about gender, about women,
but Fiona, Fiona, if I can come in, you know, if somebody's looking for their pleasure late at night, they're not going to be considering those questions. They're going to be considering what's free, what's available, what can I get my hands on? And Cindy, this is where you come in. So why don't you tell us, Make Love Not Porn is an attempt to what, bring realism back into it?
Well, our mission at Make Love Not Porn is to help make it easier to talk about sex in a way that ends rape culture. I started Make Love Not Porn 12 years ago because of my own lived experience with younger men and realising that when total access to porn online meets the fact we don't talk about sex, porn becomes sex education by default in not a good way. And I want to emphasize, as I said in my TED talk when I launched Make Love Not Porn 12 years ago, and I've been saying ever since, the issue isn't porn. The issue is that we don't talk about sex openly and honestly in the real world. And so people aren't able to bring a healthy real world mindset when they view what is performative produced entertainment.
But you have to pay to access your site. And just to say, it's people uploading their own films of themselves having sex, which isn't obviously porn actors with a director per se. It's real sex.
But I started effectively the Facebook of social sex. And that's because when I say we don't talk about sex in the real world, a very important thing to be aware of is that the white male-founded tech platforms that dominate our lives today censor women's experiences and any attempt by sex tech, femtech founders like me to bring a healthy female lens to sexual health and wellness. And so when that conversation is not being had in our homes and our schools, when it's also not being had on social platforms the way that many of us want to, nobody is talking about sex. And when we don't socialize sex, we don't socialize good sexual values and good sexual behavior. And so if porn is the Hollywood blockbuster movie, Make Love Not Porn is the real world documentary.
But no, no offense to your business, Cindy, and there'll be others like it. I go back to my point, which is a trend just online. People often don't want to pay for things. They want things that are easily accessible, and they want to just go to some of those massive sites that you've talked about, adults included.
Yep. So I've been trying to raise funding for 7 years to build out an expansion of Make Love Not Porn that would be what I call the Khan Academy of Sex Education. Free to access, more formalized sex education. Frankly, the battle I fight to keep day-to-day is extraordinary, and nobody will even fund that. And by the way, friends have said, Cindy, the UK government should be funding Make Love Not Porn. Hello, UK government, yes, please.
Well, that's a whole other question I can put to a member of them if they ever come on. But I really want to take it away from your business, if I can, per se. Sure. I understand that's your mission. But to bring you back into this, Fiona, which is that, you know, you can argue she's not getting the funding there, but you can also argue that there's not the audience. Like, the audience has already been trained, Fiona, to want to go and get free stuff that's available that looks like, in inverted commas, what we've become used to as porn. Because there's style of public sex, isn't there?
Talking to women that they're not interested even in looking for feminist pornography. And we know this is the same about ethical consumption across practices. I mean, we all know that there are some companies that are selling clothes at prices that it can't be ethically produced. That's not ethical, but we still buy it because it's cheap, because we're being trained in this version of consumer capitalism. And that is applying to pornography. What Cindy's saying is absolutely right, though. We need to start having these big conversations, because porn is stepping into this cultural vacuum around talking about porn, and it's co-opting that, and it's telling us what we should be desiring. We need to start changing that. We need to start changing that conversation and talking back, talking without judgment, creating some open spaces for us to talk about sexual pleasure, sexual practice. So when you said, you know, if it's late at night and we want to really quickly get off on something, so actually what comes in there is that ethical kind of sense in our head, is this something that we really want? Can we see the problem that this is creating in the world? And if we can, is there another way that we can get that kind of instant payoff that we're looking for? We need to start focusing on the social function, the social harms of pornography.
And changing how we come to it. But I know that you've been looking at this, that kids, age 10, 11, they're looking at porn. If parents don't think they are, I know you think they're sort of not engaging with reality. When you say we need to have these conversations, have you got any advice for people who want to talk to younger people about watching porn, who are also themselves watching the same sort of stuff?
It's really, really hard. I mean, some of this, it needs to be a much broader cultural conversation, I think. The research that I've done and work that I've done with kids, and it makes sense, kids don't want to talk to their parents about porn and sex. Parents, though, in some ways, I'm not sure if that's the most productive or useful space to have those conversations. But we need to start producing and creating some different cultural stories. Sex education, which was mandated, 5 years ago now, that we still don't have in school. We need to start funding specialist women's services who can do some of this work in schools with young people, and creating ways for young people to have conversations in this open way about what they're finding, what they're accessing, and how it's making them feel, because they're not having a good time at the moment. This idea that porn, everyone's having a good time with it, is absolutely not true. And we need to create a space to start talking about that conflict.
Cindy, there's a big push there to have this conversation, but just kind of with the brute reality that you've seen with some of these platforms, what do you think would make these platforms change what they're offering? Or do you think we're stuck with it?
No, we're absolutely not. And by the way, I do just want to make you aware that parents are buying their over 18 children and 20 something children subscriptions to Make Love Not Porn because they want them to see what happy, healthy sexual relationships look like. I'll tell you the answer to how we could actually transform the porn industry. And by the way, this is also basically how you transform popular culture in general, because this is an enormously nuanced issue. And we are living in a patriarchal society where every aspect of popular culture is dominated at the top by men. Basically, if women began talking openly about the fact that we enjoy watching porn, then the porn industry has to sit up and take notice of the fact there's a huge market and support actually many wonderful female queer pornographers who are making very different kinds of porn. Porn is not one big homogenous mass. But I think it's also equally important to bear something in mind. I wish society understood women enjoy sex just as much as men, and men are just as romantic as women. Neither gender is allowed to openly celebrate that fact. We'd all be better off if they were. Toxic masculinity means there's enormous peer pressure on boys to go along with a core, look at this. And if they're at all romantic or, you know, vulnerable, they're not encouraged to express that at all. We need to allow open conversations about love, intimacy, connection, across genders in a way that then balances out in the real world what is currently the only place people see sex actually happening. They need to see many more nuanced takes on that to be able to understand that, you know, you'll be so much happier when you're able to express yourself freely and connect with somebody in a really wonderful real world way.
Well, I mean, you two obviously have no issue talking about this, but a lot of people do, and a lot of calls here for conversation. I want to read you a message from a message from Jonathan, who's just texted in specifically to you, Fiona, saying, I probably saw 6 or 7 murders on early evening television last week for lightweight entertainment, but I don't feel the need to go out and hurt anyone. I'm able to distinguish dreams from reality like everyone else. So with porn, this outrage is ridiculous. We all know they're just acting. It's not real. Fiona, you've looked into what's actually being offered on mainstream sites and how abusive that is at times as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I'm not making a causal argument. This is not about an individual-based causal argument. You watch porn, you feel like this. This is about recognizing that pornography has this social function about setting expectations about sex. And particularly when we're talking about younger people, those expectations are being set before they have the opportunity to start to test things out themselves, before they're having the opportunity to think about what might I like, what might I not like. So young women that I've spoken to have talked about, you know, for years and years, feeling like they had to like being spat on, they had to like having their hair pulled, they had to like being slapped, and only getting into their mid to late 20s, starting to feel a bit more sure of themselves, where they felt that they could say, I'm not sure that I actually do like that, you know, but they were unable to do those really basic things at the beginning of their sexual experience, where they start to test out what they like and what they don't like, because those expectations about pleasure have been set. And I just want to make a point about the porn companies. We need to start holding them accountable. It's just ridiculous. You know, we know this famous line about the internet, if it's free, you're the product, you know. And so what's happening at the moment is mainstream pornography platforms are monetizing the access of children and young people, and no one is doing anything about it. So the government needs to act now. We need to keep the pressure on until they do. And we need to understand that this isn't about a single cause. No one is saying that pornography is the single causal reason that we're living in this conducive context for violence that we are. But it is the contributing factor, and we need to start doing something about it.
Thank you very much to both of you. So many messages coming in on this. Dr. Fiona Vera Gray and Cindy Gullop there talking about how we need to talk about this differently and how we need to hold those companies to account and change things. Your speaker just said parents don't want to talk to their kids about this and that, vice versa. Surely that's the key. They just need to step up and grow up. My children are 20 and 18. Nothing is off the table, says Sarah. Come round mine for dinner. It's not porn per se that is the main problem. It's the pornification of everyday life. Wherever anyone looks, print or media or social media especially, there are images of young women in a highly sexualized way. It's sad to say most of the images on Instagram are put there by women themselves, portraying themselves as sexually desirable and available. Perhaps you should question why women are doing this and what the consequences of doing so are all too predictable. Well, you could tie that back to what we just heard around women thinking what's normal and what they should be putting out there in the first place. Just a correction from yesterday's programme when we were talking about this issue. Ava Vakal, we described as a former pupil of King's College School, Wimbledon, London. She was talking about experiences from school that she'd gleaned from other people she'd been at school with. She was, in fact, a former pupil at Wimbledon High School. Keep your messages coming in, 84844. Do let us know what you think about this and also your own experiences. We're having a very frank chat. Just let me read this one. I'm a 16-year-old girl from a small school. I feel strongly about feminism. I want to advocate more open conversation in school about assault and harassment and what they are and the consequences for it. The 15 to 16-year-old boys in my school must be aware that the constant stream of derogatory terms, unwanted pictures and catcalls are wrong, but they may be oblivious as to just how punishable they can be. To be honest, so am I. No one's conversing with young people on how to report this abuse and how to deal with it. And instead, I feel there's a large grey area on punishments for this abuse. Porn definitely plays a part. It almost advocates the diminishing of women, not only during sex, but also in everyday life, but also the fact that senior members of the school, mostly men, are not infiltrating the consequences or threatening the constant harassment that many of us girls experience during school. So putting a few things together for us, that message there from a 16-year-old girl. Thank you for that. Keep them coming in. But we all know about Swiss Army knives, but I'm going to ask you something I've never asked before. What about Swiss Army knickers? It does sound like the beginning of a bad joke, especially what we've just been talking about. But I'm actually going to talk about Swiss Army knickers because it turns out that in an effort to get more women to sign up for a life in the military, Swiss recruits are going to be allowed to wear women's underwear for the first time. It also made us wonder about the uniforms of women in the British military. So to discuss that, I'm joined now by Dr. Jenny Mathers, Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Aberystwyth University. Good morning.
Good morning.
You did have to read, or I certainly did, this story twice just to check it wasn't a joke.
Yes, I had to double check the calendar as well, because if I'd seen it tomorrow rather than today, I would have assumed that it was an April Fool's joke. But no, it's true. It's absolutely genuine.
Yes, because until now, women have been wearing what the men have been wearing. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, when you join the military, obviously the army issues you with a whole set of uniforms and boots and all the rest of it, everything that you're meant to need for your working life in the military. And of course, even though women have been in the Swiss military for, you know, a generation or more, and they've been doing all the same kinds of jobs that men do, it's only just now that the Swiss Army has decided, oh, perhaps actually we should issue them with appropriate clothing, including underwear. So, including
knickers. We have got you on to talk about knickers in the military. But, you know, jokes aside, although it is something just to think, oh my gosh, how is this happening right now? But at least it's happening. I remember doing a piece actually for Radio 4 about women on the front line, and I went to interview women in Canada. They joined, some of the women I've been talking about, there had been a one-size-fits-all bra until quite recently.
Well, I would be tempted to say at least they had one. You know, I shudder to think what women in the Swiss Army have had to put up with before now. But I mean, it's absolutely typical. This is the sort of thing which, you know, going right back 100 years or more, anytime women begin to enter a military, this is one of the first things that they discover, is that the military hasn't really thought through these basic things like, you know, what size boots they need to have for women and what size uniforms and so on and so forth. And, you know, you quickly realize that everything in the military is geared for men, and not just the clothing, but also the equipment, the weapons, everything is designed with men in mind. And these just create additional barriers and hurdles to women's integration into the military. And it usually takes quite a long time for these kinds of problems to be rectified.
Yes, I mean, I did sort of shudder at the thought of a one size fits all bra, even if they were lucky to have one, because that would be quite an interesting experiment to see what size you'd put it at. But apparently when they then got an allowance to buy bra, which were allowed with the uniform regulations, the men were quite jealous because they wanted to have better fitted pants themselves. Do you think, though, that these sorts of things, and you can argue it's military playing catch up, do you think they can have an impact in women thinking that this is more of a world for them?
Well, yes, only though if it's part of a much bigger program of looking at what women's experience in the military is, and what kinds of things really need to change in order for women to be integrated into the military in a way that's not just tokenistic. And so this underwear move is part of a wider effort to increase the recruitment of women in the Swiss Army. And presently, only 0.8% of the Swiss Army is comprised of women, and they're aiming for 10% by 2030. So this is, you know, quite an ambitious attempt. And so if it is accompanied by other measures which make it clear that women have real opportunities, and that, you know, women's experiences in the military is something that could be positive for them and not just, you know, endless misery and trying to deal with all kinds of problems, you know, like the underwear problem, then yes, potentially it could have a difference.
Why the attempt to boost the number of women in the first place, do you think?
Right. Well, there are lots of reasons why militaries decide to try and encourage women to join. I mean, classically, the one reason is because they can't get enough men. Now, in Switzerland, they have universal male conscription. So, you know, on the one hand, you would think perhaps that's not an issue. But if the birth rates have been falling, then that might be an issue, actually. So, you know, having enough people is one reason to expand, but also kind of trying to keep in step with society, with civilian society's norms. So if civilian society is moving towards more gender equal, you know, lifestyles and workplaces and so on, then the military very often will feel the need to try and catch up. And also, of course, you know, it enables them to benefit from the skills and the intellect and all the characteristics that half the population have, which they're previously not benefiting from.
You were saying you would have thought this was an April Fool's joke. How's the British military looking in comparison?
Well, as far as I know, they allow women to wear women's underwear. But certainly, you know, there's a much higher proportion of women than that in the British military. But still, you know, there's a whole wide range of issues that women face in state militaries really around the world, including in Britain. And sexual harassment is one of them. It's been a very big issue, particularly in the US, but it's increasingly coming to the attention of people in the UK as well. So
indeed, you know, we're actually going to look at that very soon here on Women's Hour, because there was talk of the kind of Me Too moment in the British military for women. Thank you very much for your time, taking some time to talk about our briefs in quite an important way, it seems. Dr. Jenny Mathers, Senior Lecturer at International Politics, Aberystwyth University. Now let's talk to Erin Kelly about a very different world. She's written 8 thrillers. I'm sure many of you will have read them, including the best-selling He Said, She Said. Her latest, Watch Her Fall, is set in the world of elite ballet. So from military to dance, the London Russian Ballet Company, led by the charismatic and controlling Nikolai Kirillov. His daughter Ava's about to dance the role of Odette in Swan Lake in a new and much anticipated production. She has lived for dance all her life, and her journey to the top has required total dedication. But when an overheard comment feeds her paranoia, Ava's life goes in. I don't want to ruin anything in the book. And there is a big twist, Erin. We'll talk about twists in just a moment. But welcome to Woman's Hour. Tell us why the world of ballet. What drew you to that?
Well, I grew up reading ballet books. So from a little girl, I remember reading a book about a dancing bunny rabbit. And then I moved on to Ballet Shoes by Nell Stratfield. There's some fantastic YA, young adult fiction, written about the ballet world. Gino, I read when I was growing up and devoured her books. There are very few adult novels about that world. And I do love the ballet. I thought I knew about it before I started this book. My mum is a huge fan, and I grew up, you know, the Nutcracker at Christmas. And but it is a world that is just extremely intense and competitive. And it's always seemed to me to be fantastic grounds for a psychological thriller, because it's very, so I like to write about people under incredible pressure and on the edge of sanity. And everybody knows what dancers have to do to maintain their physical peak. But what's really interesting to me is the psychology that goes along with that, the kind of mindset you need to sacrifice a normal childhood, normal social life, your teenage years when everybody else is out dating and drinking cider in a park. You're there at the bar putting in 10-hour days. And also the knowledge that by the time you're 30, you need to do something else. So you give up your life, and the clock is always ticking. It's incredibly competitive. There's only, you know, the spotlight can only shine on one person at a time. It just felt to me like an incredibly rich world to explore.
When you were talking to dancers about it, did you get a sense that that's changing? The clock ticking certainly isn't, in terms of what they're able to do by what age, but is it moving with the time slightly?
It absolutely is. And actually the clock ticking isn't what it was, because sports medicine is incredible and it's advancing. And what I was very interested in is that all the major companies now have psychologists who will work with their dancers along with a physio, so that they can keep their mindset healthy for longer as well as their bodies. That said, what dancers are now expected to do because of that same sports science is much more athletic and much more demanding. Dancers now, female dancers now, are athletes in a way that maybe they weren't 50 years ago. I mean, ballet's never been easy. Anybody who's ever tried to kind of rise up on point or stand on one leg knows that it's a kind of superhuman skill set.
I have the mangled toes to prove it. I did dabble. but you know, you very clearly, when I was doing ballet when I was growing up, you know, I did not have the figure for it, because I had a figure. That was the whole thing. You know, quite quickly you were told, if you had boobs, if you had hips, not for you.
Yeah, I danced. I danced as a teenager, but I quit ballet when I was 8. Not that I had hips and boobs at that age, but it was already clear that the girls who were going to progress were the, you know, the sylphs, if you like. And there's a line in the book when the ballet master sees one of his girls and he kind of looks on shocked and says, "She gets hips." And that's a direct quote from one of the dancers who I interviewed for the book. Yeah. You can spend 2 hours watching a production and not see anybody who needs a bra. And if you ever do see anybody who has a figure, it's usually in contemporary dance. And partly that is because of the astonishing workload that you put yourself through. When most bodies are going through puberty, a body which is dancing for 8 hours and is, dancers now will tell you that they eat intelligently rather than fast. But, right, you know, you don't look like that on cream cakes all day, every day. And when your body is under that kind of stress, puberty often is delayed and sometimes never really happens until dancers retire. That's when a more kind of heavy womanly shape will finally be allowed in.
What's your view of that world now you've properly...
Well, I held dancers in high regard before. Now I'm absolutely in awe of that discipline and of how creative they are. The company in my book is fictitious and it's very old-fashioned. Russian ballet in particular is astonishingly disciplined. It's mathematical precision, and that does seem to be changing. There seems to be more diversity in, I mean, what dancers call diversity in body shape, we would still reckon, you know, mortals would still recognise as somebody who could barely bust out of a size 10, but, you know, dancers of colour are making waves in a way that they weren't a generation ago. So it's changing, but there are still incredible restrictions, and it's just very, very closed world.
Let me ask you about this big plot twist. That's what thrillers, mm-hmm, you know, rely on, a bit of misdirection there. How do you go about making that work? Do you always want to have that within your books?
I think readers love twists. They love to be able to talk about them and compare notes. Did you guess? When did you guess? I guessed on page X. I guessed on page X, but three paragraphs later.
Yeah.
I mean, my books are really popular with book clubs for exactly this reason. And of course, nobody wants to read any book, let alone a thriller, knowing what's going to happen next. And they're huge fun. They're huge fun. They are very difficult to write. And I would never set out to plant a twist in a book for the sake of it. It's got to belong organically in the novel and not feel like something that's tacked on and not feel too much like plot pyrotechnics for the sake of it. But what I will do when I have my first draft, when I know what I'm trying to hide, is I will then go back and analyze page by page. So sometimes it's, you know, you have to go through every sentence and check that the right pronouns are being used if you're trying to deflect attention from one character to another. And you can't lie to a reader because then they'll finish the book feeling cheated and withhold information. And you can lead people down a different path by manipulating their assumptions. But it is just a case of revision and revision. And also there's more to it than the mechanics of the plot. Whenever there's been books that have given me a real pull the rug, gasp out loud moment, so I'm thinking of a book like Rebecca or Fingersmith by Sarah Waters or Shutter Island by Dennis Lehane, it's because I have been immersed in something else. It's because there has been some really beautiful language, or I'm learning about a world I didn't know anything about, or there's a love story that's completely swept me up. And that's a misdirection in itself. That's another kind of sleight of hand. So I've tried to do all those things with Watch Her Fall, so that when they're so busy enjoying the story, you weren't expecting that. And that's what a twist is. It's not with a whodunit, you always know what the question is. The question is, who is the killer? We don't start this book with a dead body. It's a different kind of crime fiction where you're working towards something terrible happening. But unknown.
Exactly. I'm going to have to stop you there to go to our own drama. And also, I don't want me or you to give anything away. Watch Her Fall by Erin Kelly. Thank you for talking to us. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hello, I'm Vanessa Casile. And there is nothing I love more than a great documentary.
I'm woken by the sound of gunfire.
There's something about a true story told well that changes your perspective on the world.
He trusted the wrong people and it's obviously cost him his life.
Radio 4 is home to the world's greatest audio documentaries.
A film showing bright pink bottoms sitting on Victoria sponge cakes is projected onto a screen over the stage.
And you can find the best of them all in one place, twice a week.
Although we can see and hear these animals, they're literally living their lives at a different speed to us.
The podcast is called Seriously. Subscribe now on the BBC Sounds app.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never-ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.